arraignment is set for next week, and an anticipated not guilty plea for the 17-year-old charged with homicide for fatally shooting three people and wounding a third in the August unrest in Kenosha following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. We're looking at the latest developments in the case here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The family of 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse has been raising money for his criminal defense. He was released on $2 million bail a little over a month ago. Have you been following the case? What do you think of the family's fundraising tactics? It's 800-642-1234. Bruce Velmetti covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Bruce, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
So explain, before we get into the charges, explain where we are in this case with the court proceedings.
Well, as you just mentioned, Kate, the arraignment is coming up on the 5th, and that'll be, it's a pretty pro forma hearing generally. He'll appear in court virtually by Zoom and enter a formal not guilty plea. That's about where we're at. There's really not been much else happening in the case, and from there, it'll move into the longer drawn out, you know, discovery and scheduling, and I imagine that'll take quite a while.
Explain where we are with the charges. What is Rittenhouse currently charged with?
Well, actually, he's charged with an additional new count that they just added this week. It's minor. It's a ticket, actually. He was for violating curfew, essentially, is all it is. But he's facing the more serious counts are five felonies and a misdemeanor. And they are first-degree intentional homicide. That's the most serious count. That was for the first death. The first man he shot, that was Joseph Rosenbaum. First-degree reckless homicide is the another death. Obviously, that's Mr. Huber. First-degree reckless endangering safety. He faces two counts of that. These are for shots he fired, which prosecutors meant, you know, were aimed at somebody but didn't hit anyone. Attempted first-degree intentional homicide. That's Mr. Grosskreutz. The gentleman was shot in the elbow. And then kind of a more interesting and contentious is the misdemeanor count, which is possession of a gun, firearm, by someone under 18 years old. That would seem the simplest, but his lawyers insist online and in court have tried to have that thrown out, arguing that that's that he was entitled at 17 to carry the rifle.
And so this has been one of the contentions here by the defense team trying to remove two of the charges, but that was denied by the Kenosha County Court Commissioner. Is that right?
That's right. That's this issue of whether he's allowed to carry the rifle. I think it's been argued now before the commissioner, and I think they'll bring it up again with the court, but I think it's pretty clear that the courts aren't going to go for that. It's based on a real kind of interesting reading of the statute, and the statute's admittedly confusing and poorly written in the exception that they're citing, but it's kind of one of these where, in the larger sense, it doesn't make sense for the exception to apply, I think. I think that's how most of the judges are going to see it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with reporter Bruce Velmetti, who covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the Rittenhouse case. Have you been following this case? What would you like to know about it? 800-642-1234 to join in. So this is set against the backdrop of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Kenosha after Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot multiple times by a white officer. What have social justice efforts looked like surrounding this case and what the connection here is to Rittenhouse?
Well, clearly it was the demonstrations in the wake of the Blake shooting that brought all these people into Kenosha that evening, including Kyle Rittenhouse. You know, since then, he and his support, it's kind of hard to tell. I guess there haven't been a lot of demonstrations exactly focused about the Rittenhouse case. When I was in Waukegan, Illinois, where he was initially held as a juvenile after turning himself in, there were some demonstrators outside the courthouse chanting, "Send him back." That's when he was trying to avoid extradition and fighting extradition back to Wisconsin. Some of the protesters and demonstrators have filed different civil rights lawsuits that have named him and others involved in the counter protest, if you call it, or the protection, if they'd call it, that was happening that evening. So those cases are in the federal court system as civil rights cases. Those will take much longer to play out. And again, are sort of a long reach, in my opinion, but they raise the issues you're talking about, whether the government and whether the private responders in two different cases are responsible for these deaths in a way, or from damages other demonstrators say they suffered at the hands of either Kyle Rittenhouse, other armed people who came to the events that night, or the police.
We got a call from Steve in Madison, couldn't stay with us. And Steve wants to know, is the public allowed to know who is paying for Rittenhouse's defense team? And if so, who is paying for the defense team?
Well, we're not allowed to know in exact terms, but in general, it appears at least that Second Amendment, you know, gun rights advocates and others around the country appear to be paying for his defense. When he was first charged, there was nearly $2 million donated to his defense, and that money hasn't all really been too well accounted for, and that's a separate issue. But some of it and other major donations from celebrities went to posting his $2 million bail. His family and one of his lawyers are currently beating the bushes pretty hard to raise another $2 million they say will be necessary to actually defend the case. And that's they have a website, and it sort of tracks. They claim about 1,400 people have made donations in the neighborhood of about $75,000 so far.
And just recently, one of his attorneys, John Pierce, has stepped away from the case. There's been ethical and financial issues with Pierce. What is going on there?
That's actually one of the more interesting aspects of the case, in my opinion, so far. Yes, John Pierce was a sort of self-appointed big shot lawyer from Los Angeles. He started a law firm a few years ago. The law firm very quickly kind of broke up and had a lot of debt. He was also involved in some personal litigation and a divorce. And so he teamed up with the guy, Lynn Wood, who many of the listeners might know of, is currently being involved in one of the attacks on the election results in Georgia. He's an Atlanta lawyer, became famous for defending Richard Jewell back in the Olympic bombing case in Atlanta. And they are the ones who started the foundation that secured most of the original donations for the defense. So Pierce did step away from the foundation. Now he's formally stepped away from the defense. On the other hand, he is still defending Kyle Rittenhouse continually on social media. He's very active on Twitter. He and Kyle's mother go on a lot of interviews with conservative websites. Today, I just watched one from InfoWars. That's the Alex Jones far-right network. Other areas like Blaze TV, and they're on a lot promoting the website for donations and also their theory of the defense. So technically, it's Mark Richards, who's a legitimate, very excellent criminal defense lawyer from Racine, who's handling the actual defense in the Wisconsin courts.
We're talking with Bruce Valmetti, a legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, bringing us up to speed on the case of 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who's due back in court for his arraignment next week. Have you followed this case? Have you donated to the family's criminal defense fund? Why did you decide to donate? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the latest in the criminal case of the 17-year-old Kenosha shooter. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse is charged with fatally shooting two people during the August protest following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. He was released from jail last month after posting a $2 million cash bail, and his arraignment is set for next week. What questions do you have? Are you an attorney following this case? What do you think of the defense's fundraising? What are you watching for in court proceedings? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Bruce Valmetti covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's our guide. Let's take a call now. Jimmy is joining us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Morning. I was wondering if the district attorney considered something lower than first-degree murder, because and hopefully they'll be able to, the jury will be able to consider something less than that, because I worry about these all-or-nothing charges where it might be a reach to go to first-degree murder when a lower charge might be easier to prove. And I was wondering if the police or the authorities in charge have faced any blowback for allowing these folks to roam around with weapons in you know, such a volatile situation. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Jimmy, thank you for that. And Bruce, starting with the prosecution and what its approach is to this case.
The gentleman has a good question. I was frankly a little surprised that one of the counts included first degree intentional homicide. If you, and I'm sure everyone's seen the video by now, the same video that Kyle's defense team says shows he's clearly acting in self-defense and that he shouldn't have been charged at all is pretty unclear about the first count. That's the intentional homicide count, and that's involving Joseph Rosenbaum. That's the one you really can't see as well what happened. But I think they may have done that just because they can also get that. It may have had something to do with his arraignment. I mean, the extradition. While he was still in Illinois, he was not entitled to any kind of bail because of the first-degree intentional homicide count that may put him in potential life imprisonment. And that triggered a provision in the extradition laws that said he couldn't get any kind of bail while he was in Illinois. I think they really are ready on almost any kind of these first-degree intentional homicide cases. Most of the time, the jury does have the option of what they call a lesser-included offense, maybe reckless homicide, that kind of thing. So that's very likely going to come into play here, I believe, that the first-degree intentional homicide is unlikely to be convicted, the convicted count.
Rittenhouse had an AR-15 at the time of the shooting, and prosecutors have said an older friend bought him the rifle. What do we know? What do you know about the weapon?
The weapon's interesting. That's his friend Dominic Black, who's 19 and is or was, at least at the time, dating Kyle's sister. That's how they knew each other. They also had been up and purchased the weapon earlier in the year in the spring when Kyle joined Dominic's family up north in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. And Kyle has said, told the police that he had extra money. He'd gotten a couple of unemployment checks. And if you remember early in the pandemic, there was an extra $600, which I'm sure was well more than he was normally earning as a lifeguard. And he had decided to spend $1,200 or so on this rifle. He couldn't buy it, of course, at 17, but his friend was 18 and bought it for him. And they used it to shoot targets out in the rural areas up north. And his friend Dominic also kept the gun at his father's house in Kenosha. So the early disputes and rumors was that he'd gone across state lines with the rifle and all that weren't true. The rifle stayed in Wisconsin the whole time. But his friend is charged with getting him the rifle, both when he obtained it for him from the store, purchased it, and also when he gave it to him before they went downtown that evening. So he faces two counts of a felony. Each is punishable by like about 3 years in prison.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Bruce Valmetti, who is a legal affairs reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's bringing us up to speed on the Rittenhouse case and taking your questions, your insights about it, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mary Kay now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay. What would you like to say?
Good morning. About the straw purchase, I do believe that man should be charged, okay? It was a straw sale. Another thing is my city was burning. That was my city. The entire city was burning. We had to call in people from outside to protect us. This was a very young man that was protecting himself. I seen the video. So again, I would like them to look at that too in self-defense.
And Bruce Rittenhouse has told police he was attacked while guarding a business.
That's not quite, I mean, he was guarding a business. That was his initial effort, his intention there. He was with several other armed men at one of the three locations for, I think it's called CarSource. But when he was actually attacked, he was actually walking away towards one of the other locations. And if you watch the videos, and there are many different cuts of the video, independent people have made anywhere from 11 minute to an hour compilations of the various videos that were taken that evening. So when he was actually attacked, he was on his way walking towards the location at 53rd and Sheridan Road, 63rd and Sheridan, when Mr. Rosenbaum began chasing him. So he was kind of out on the street walking, wasn't clearly protecting the business at the time. And then, of course, after the initial shooting, he was kind of escaping the growing crowd that was yelling, hey, that guy shot someone, and they were beginning to gather and chase after him at that point, yes.
These cell phone videos, will they be used as credible evidence for either the prosecution or defense teams or both?
Oh, clearly both. I mean, I was going way back to the days of the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, I think back in the early 90s. Video is that very powerful piece of evidence, right? People see it and think it clearly shows one thing or clearly shows another. But over and over and over, when you get a piece of video to court and break it down frame by frame and bring in experts to discuss actions people are taking in those frames, video is never as clear as it looks in the first light, in my opinion. So yes, both sides will be making extensive use of the video. Obviously, there were also eyewitnesses to these events. I don't believe they've been able to find some of them, including one of the gentlemen who is seen kicking at Kyle early on before he fires at the people on the street in Sheridan, on Sheridan Road. One of the last hearings in court, I think it was said that they still haven't identified that person. He's a potential victim who was shot at, but they don't even know who that is. And that could be the case with a lot of these other people out in the field who saw things. On the other hand, there have been investigators for both the prosecutor's office and the defense trying to track down and interview these people ever since. So we may find out a lot of new information from their perspectives when the trial begins, if it ever begins.
When you look at the defense team's efforts to raise the bail, to raise additional millions of dollars for the defense, selling merchandise to help pay for the defense, how has the public responded to these requests?
Well, it's hard to tell. Mr. Pierce, that's the Los Angeles lawyer sort of leading what he calls the civil side of the defense. You know, he clearly makes it sound like there are thousands and thousands of people out there who support Kyle. And there probably are in the sense that among gun rights advocates, you know, the Second Amendment and self-defense has sort of been the core reason they've all been pushing over the years and finally successful. I mean, most states allowed concealed carry and always are opposing any kinds of restrictions on gun sales and use. So a lot of those people, without knowing much else about the case, I think are willing to back Kyle and at least be sure that he has a fair defense. Whether it goes beyond that, I'm not sure. Their lawyer is trying to spin some of this into future civil cases of defamation, which is sort of his specialty before he got involved in this. So they're looking for people to sue. They repeatedly claim they're going to sue President Biden, President-elect Biden's campaign over a piece that ran back in October after one of the debates in which reference was made to white supremacy and it showed Kyle's picture at the time. And so they're threatening to sue anybody who mentions Kyle in the same breath with white supremacists, that kind of thing. So they're looking for money down the line in terms of damages in addition to funds to fund the defense.
Bruce, as we wrap up here very quickly, no trial date set yet in the middle of a pandemic. What is the timeline for this?
That's a really good question. I would expect that no trial date will be set till very late in 2021, if not 2022. This is the kind of case that will have endless kinds of pretrial litigation. There should be lots of fights over the discovery materials. And again, as you mentioned, the pandemic makes all this a little more tricky because they're doing lots of it remotely. I know some counties are having, you know, trials in person and hearings, and they might move to that sooner than we think, and that'd be great. But even in normal times, this would be a very long, drawn-out case, in my opinion.
Bruce, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Bruce Valmetti, legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a link to his work at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we learn what goes into making outdoor dining reality. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network.